In Minneapolis, New Year's Eve is often a time for celebration. Families gather to toast to new beginnings. Friends huddle around fireplaces to escape the icy winter air, and the streets are abuzz with anticipation of midnight fireworks. New Year's Eve 2019 was no exception. The temperature was a bone-chilling 27 degrees. Snow had fallen lightly throughout the day, leaving a thin layer of powder over the city. The overcast skies dimmed the last traces of daylight, and the back alleys of the 1300 block of Russell Avenue North were particularly gloomy. But as the clock ticked toward the new year, the city's usual winter hush leading up to midnight was pierced by a chilling alert. In North Minneapolis, at 6:38 p.m., the city's shot spotter detected the unmistakable cracks of gunfire. Three rapid shots that shattered the eerie quiet of a snow-covered, overcast evening. Inside the Minneapolis Police Department, officers monitoring the system sprang into action. A report of shots fired in a known violent area demanded immediate attention. Patrol cars raced through the icy streets, their sirens slicing through the quiet neighborhood. When the first officers arrived at the scene, they braced for the usual chaos of a gun battle. But this was no random gun battle. As their flashlights swept across the dark, snowy path, something immediately stood out. There, on the icy ground, they discovered the lifeless body of a young woman, sprawled across the cold ground, as though she had been carelessly discarded. Officers approached cautiously, their boots crunching in the snow, the sound unnervingly loud in the heavy silence. The dim alley lights, combined with the flashing red and blue police lights, created an almost surreal scene. Homicide detectives were quickly dispatched. Arriving at the scene, the detectives found the young woman with her wrists bound in duct tape. Blood stained the snow around her still form. The spatter on the snow and positioning of her body told the officers she had been killed here, right where she lay. Two spent .45 caliber shell casings glinted in the light. Their metallic shine, a cold reminder of the violence that had just unfolded. Her coat lay nearby, tossed aside, and beside her was a partial lockbox, a puzzling detail detectives knew would hold great significance. Though its role was unclear, it was unique enough to be a potential key to unraveling the mystery. She had been shot at close range, one to the face and two to the torso. It was a haunting testament to her final moments, leaving detectives to wonder, who was this young woman, and what could have driven someone to end her life so brutally on this fateful night? This is the tragic story of Monique Bao, a 28-year-old mother of two whose life ended far too soon on a snowy New Year's Eve in Minneapolis. It is a story of ambition, jealousy, betrayal, and the senseless violence that stole her future. Hello, and welcome to today's episode of Sleuthy Stories. If you're new here, this is the podcast where real-life mysteries unfold, one clue at a time. The audio for today's story has been pulled from my main YouTube channel and remastered for this podcast experience. If you'd like to see the visuals that accompany this case, head over to my YouTube channel, Sleuthy Lucy. But for now, sit back, listen closely, and let's unravel the mystery together. Thanks for being here. Today's episode is sponsored by Aura, a comprehensive service that protects you and your loved ones from those who wish to exploit your trust online. Ever get one of those strange text messages from USPS saying they have a package for you? Click this link to confirm. USPS never sends those types of messages. That's spam from scammers who likely got your information from a data broker or a leak on the dark web. Do you know how much of your personal information is out there? Your full name, phone number, home address, email, even details about your relatives can be sold to scammers, like the ones behind that USPS text message. That's why I turn to Aura. Aura not only monitors your information on the dark web, but it also automatically sends opt-out requests to data brokers on your behalf. It has helped me remove my information from over 18 data brokers, and even alerted me that one of my email addresses was found on the dark web. With Aura, I also enjoy features like antivirus, VPN, password management, and identity theft insurance, all in one affordable package. If you sign up through my link right now at aura.com/sleuthylucy, Aura will give you a 2-week free trial. For a more direct route, click the link in the description below. It was a busy night for Minneapolis law enforcement. While families prepared to celebrate the arrival of a new decade for Minneapolis police, the night was far from festive. Just 1 hour before the city's shot spotter detected gunshots on Russell Avenue, chaos had erupted at a residence located on the 4800 block of Humboldt Avenue North. It began with the chilling sound of gunfire. Shots rang out inside a quiet family home, shattering the peace of the neighborhood. Concerned neighbors, startled by the noise, immediately dialed 911 to report the disturbance. Police units were dispatched to the scene, where they discovered a grim and alarming situation. Inside the home, officers found a young man lying gravely wounded, John Mitchell Momo, a father of 2 young daughters, Legend, aged 3, and Legacy, just 1, who were both in the home at the time. He was discovered in an upstairs bedroom, shot multiple times, with one of his daughters nearby. It was a haunting scene that underscored the brutality of the violence that had unfolded. Paramedics were called without delay. When they arrived, they found John barely clinging to life. Gunshot wounds riddled his torso and legs, and he was lying in a pool of blood. His injuries were severe, and every second counted. The medical team worked quickly to stabilize him before rushing him to North Memorial Health Hospital, where he would fight for his life. As the chaos unfolded inside the house, the neighborhood buzzed with concern. A worried next-door neighbor, aware that the home belonged to Wanda Bao, took it upon himself to alert her. Wanda was just finishing her shift at work. Her routine was simple. Finish her duties, head to her locker, and check her phone for any missed calls or messages. That night, a message stood out. A cryptic and ominous, "Call me." Alarmed, Wanda immediately dialed the number. On the other end, the neighbor's voice was grave. "A guy got shot at your house." Panic set in as Wanda demanded, "What? No. Where's my daughter?" The reply was devastating. "I don't know." Overwhelmed with fear, Wanda frantically called Monique, her daughter, but each call went unanswered. Without wasting another moment, she rushed home. When Wanda arrived at the house, she was met with the aftermath of violence. The police had cordoned off the area, and she learned that John, Monique's boyfriend, and the father of her granddaughters, Legacy and Legend, had been rushed to the hospital in critical condition. The sight of the bloodied scene made her heart race, but one question consumed her: where was Monique? Desperate for answers, Wanda went straight to her granddaughters as soon as she arrived home. Little Legend, the oldest at just 3 years old, was sitting quietly, her innocent face unaware of the gravity of the night's events. "Where's Mommy?" Wanda asked gently. Legend's response was simple, almost comforting: "Mommy's at work." It wasn't unusual for Monique to be working. She was dedicated to her career as a real estate agent. But this time, given the circumstances, something about her absence felt deeply unsettling. Officers were everywhere, their presence filling Wanda with an unease that refused to subside. As she stood there, trying to make sense of what was happening, she couldn't shake the growing fear in her gut. Wanda tried calling Monique again, still no answer. It wasn't like her daughter to ignore her calls, especially not repeatedly. Officers suggested she send a text, hoping that a message might elicit a response. Wanda did as they asked, but the silence persisted. It wasn't just unusual, it was alarming. "She's a realtor," Wanda explained to the officers, her voice trembling. "She went to a house showing today. I didn't know she had one scheduled, but it's not unusual for her to work on a day like this." But her worry deepened as she continued. "Even if she's working, she always picks up. Even if she can't talk, she'll answer and say, I'll call you back. This isn't like her. Something's wrong. The officers tried to console her, assuring her they would figure things out, but their words did little to ease her terror. Maybe she's been taken, Wanda said, her voice steady but laced with dread. Taken? One officer asked. Yes, Wanda insisted. Whoever did this to John, whoever shot him, they could have my daughter. She wouldn't just not respond to me. It's not like her. As she voiced her fears, Wanda's eyes darted around the chaotic scene. Amidst the commotion, something caught her attention, a flash of purple on the rug near the front door. She stepped closer, her heart sinking as she realized what it was. It was a single key, distinctive and unmistakable, purple, with a butterfly on it. Wanda had had it made especially for Monique. It was a key that should have been on Monique's keychain, a key that should have been with her wherever she was. But there it was, lying alone, separated from its usual place. Something about it being there, out of context, struck Wanda as deeply wrong. She pointed it out to the officers, her voice breaking as she explained its significance. This key, she said, holding it up. This is Monique's. It's not supposed to be here. It's always on her keychain. Always. The sight of that lone key, combined with Monique's silence, confirmed Wanda's worst fears. Something terrible had happened to her daughter, and time was slipping away. As officers worked to secure Wanda's home and address the chaos left behind after the shooting of John Mitchell Momo, the city's ShotSpotter system alerted. This time, the alarm signaled three gunshots from the 1300 block of Russell Avenue North, a known hotspot for violence, located about 20 minutes away. Officers were quickly dispatched to the scene. Expecting the aftermath of a chaotic gunfight, the responding officers instead found an unnerving stillness. The quiet alley, blanketed in snow and dimly lit by the flicker of streetlights, offered no immediate clues to the violence that had just occurred. But as their flashlights cut through the darkness, they discovered the tragic reason for the alarm. Lying lifeless on the ground was a young Black woman. Her mouth was taped shut, and her wrists were bound with tape, signaling a brutal and calculated act of violence. Her coat lay nearby, carelessly tossed aside. Around her body were two spent .45 caliber shell casings, and a puzzling but significant clue: a lockbox, incomplete and discarded. Homicide detectives arrived shortly after, noting the gruesome details of the crime scene. The woman had been shot at close range, once in the face and twice in the torso. Her body bore the signs of a struggle: scratches, bruises, a chipped tooth, and several of her acrylic fingernails ripped off. The detectives immediately concluded that the murder had taken place in the very spot where she was found. As they began their investigation, the detectives received a call from their lieutenant. He informed them of another violent crime scene earlier that evening on Humboldt Avenue, involving a critically injured man and reports of a missing girlfriend. With this new information, one of the homicide detectives decided to leave for the Humboldt Avenue scene to see if the two incidents might be connected. The detective arrived at the Humboldt residence to find officers still processing the earlier scene. Inside the home, the .45 caliber shell casings and the pool of blood from John's shooting stood out immediately. Learning that Monique Bao, John's girlfriend and the mother of his children, was missing solidified his growing hunch. These two crime scenes were connected. To confirm his suspicions, the detective asked Wanda for photographs of Monique. Wanda pointed to pictures on the wall: Monique, John, and their two daughters smiling together in happier times. While the photos gave him a reference, the detective couldn't definitively confirm if the young woman found in the alley was Monique. He pressed further, asking Wanda if Monique had any identifying marks or tattoos. Clinging to hope that the inquiry meant progress in finding her daughter alive, Wanda replied, "Yes.
She has one at the very bottom of her pelvis that says heartbreaker."
"Okay, thank you.
She's not. She isn't.
I'm still trying to figure that out, okay?"
The detective excused himself, and stepped outside to make a private call to his partner, still at the Russell Avenue scene. "Hold on one sec, buddy," he said, steadying himself as he prepared to share the critical detail. Once outside, the reality of what he was about to confirm hit him hard.
"Hold on one sec, buddy. Stand by. Fuck. So that's the mother of the two kids from this one. Yep. Because she just said the heartbreaker tattoo."
It was Monique. Born on a crisp fall day in Minneapolis, Minnesota, Monique Latrice Leanna Bao grew up surrounded by the warmth of family and the bonds of a close-knit community. The daughter of Wanda Bao, Monique shared a home with her mother, who was her constant support and guiding light throughout her life. Monique attended Robbinsdale Armstrong High School, where her outgoing nature and vibrant personality made her a friend to many. Those who knew her describe her as magnetic, with an energy that could light up any room. She had an unwavering confidence in everything she pursued, a trait her family fondly remembers to this day.
"She just had this confidence and glow about her that you just wanted. Like, it was so infectious. Like, you just wanted to have whatever dose of Monique. Like, what did you have, Monique? We want that." So,
among the closest relationships in her life were her cousins, who were more like siblings. They shared countless memories, from playful childhood adventures to the shared challenges and triumphs of young motherhood. These connections remained a cornerstone of Monique's life as she grew older and became a mother herself. By 2019, Monique was thriving as a real estate agent, a career she pursued with determination and excitement. Her journey into real estate began with a desire to create a stable and prosperous future for herself and her family. After passing her licensing exams, she joined Chris Lindahl Real Estate on March 18, 2018. Monique was ecstatic about the opportunity, eager to learn from the best and build a career she was passionate about. Her hard work and dedication paid off, and she quickly made her mark in the industry, earning the admiration of her peers and clients alike. Outside of her career, Monique was a devoted mother to her two daughters, Legend and Legacy, aged 3 and 1. They were her pride and joy, and she poured all her love into creating a nurturing and happy home for them. Her family describes her as a wonderful, wonderful mother who would do anything for her girls. In her personal life, Monique shared a home on Humboldt Avenue with her mother, Wanda, while her boyfriend, John Mitchell Momo, frequently stayed there as well. Affectionately known as Momo, John was a rising rapper in the Minneapolis music scene, celebrated for his collaborations with major artists like Nipsey Hussle and Lil Baby. His growing success brought a dynamic and flashy lifestyle that captivated Monique. Despite the challenges they faced as a couple, Monique always saw the best in Momo, believing in his potential and their shared dreams for the future. He was the love of her life, and she deeply cherished the life they were building together. Just 2 nights before the tragedy, Monique and Momo unknowingly shared what would be their last date night together. For a brief moment, their busy lives paused, and they focused on each other. It was a night filled with laughter, love, and the connection that had brought them together in the first place. They couldn't have known it would be their last, making the memory both bittersweet and deeply cherished by those who knew how much they meant to one another. Monique's dedication to her family was unwavering. She was on a path to a bright future, driven by love for her daughters and her desire to give them everything they deserved. But in a tragic twist of fate, the life she had worked so hard to build came to a devastating end on New Year's Eve 2019. With a heavy heart, the homicide detective, who had just confirmed that the young female victim at the Russell Avenue crime scene was Monique, stepped back inside to deliver the devastating news. Wanda, holding on to hope, asked him anxiously, "Is Monique safe?" The detective's voice broke as he gently told her the truth. Her daughter had been shot and killed. Wanda's reaction was immediate and heart-wrenching. She became hysterical, overcome with grief at the loss of her daughter. The detective tried to console her as best as he could, assuring her that the team would work tirelessly to bring justice to Monique's memory and her family. But in that moment, no words could ease the immense pain Wanda felt as her worst fear became a devastating reality. Wanda's world shattered as the horrific news sank in. Monique, her only daughter, was her everything. The bond they shared was unbreakable, and the loss felt incomprehensible. Wanda couldn't begin to fathom who could commit such a cruel and senseless act, or why anyone would want to harm another human being, let alone her daughter, her baby. The questions overwhelmed her, but the answers seemed agonizingly out of reach. As the clock ticked closer to New Year's Eve celebrations, Monique's cousins grew increasingly anxious. Across town, they were eagerly preparing for Cousins' Night, a tradition Monique had started earlier that year to bring the family together. This special New Year's Eve edition was supposed to be a lively gathering with Monique, her cousins, and all of their children. It was to be a night filled with laughter, love, and tacos. Monique's last message to her cousin Sherelle was simple, yet heartfelt. She'd bring the salsa verde. As the evening went on, and Monique still hadn't arrived, her cousins grew uneasy. Every time they saw headlights approach, they hoped it was Monique and the kids, but their calls to her went straight to voicemail. Concern turned to dread as Sherelle finally called her Aunt Wanda, desperate for answers. "Where's Monique? We're all waiting for her," she asked. The response left her shattered. "Monique's dead," Wanda said. Stunned, Sherelle hung up, unable to comprehend the devastating words. The night meant for celebration had suddenly turned into an unthinkable tragedy, leaving a family broken and a tradition forever marked by sorrow. Everywhere in Minneapolis, the night crackled with anticipation for the new year. Fireworks glittered in the cold winter sky, and the city buzzed with celebrations. But for Wanda, Monique's cousins, and the rest of her family, the night was filled with anguish and the wish that they could turn back time. The family soon gathered at North Memorial Health, where Momo was undergoing surgery after surviving multiple gunshot wounds. It is also where Monique's body was taken. The weight of their grief was palpable, made heavier by unanswered questions. As detectives pressed forward with their investigation, they began digging into John Mitchell Momo's life. Who was he? Did he have enemies? What was his relationship with Monique? One detail stood out as Wanda spoke to the detectives about her concerns. Just 3 weeks prior, on December 16th, Momo had posted a music video that depicted him in a shower, surrounded by large amounts of cash, waving the bills in the air, bathing with them, and later putting them in a dryer. While Momo's followers may have found it comical, the detectives immediately recognized it as a potential lead. Wanda recalled her unease after seeing the video, realizing it had been filmed in her own home, using her shower and her dryer. She had confronted Monique about it, warning her, "Momo's image will get us killed for a like, a share, or a love." Wanda's words now carried a haunting resonance, as they were just 15 days removed from the video's release, and now Monique's dead. The detectives considered this detail significant, providing a possible motive for robbery. Yet one fact perplexed them. Whoever committed this crime had left all the valuables in the home untouched, including the Christmas tree with its gifts beneath it. Adding to the complexity of the case were the two crime scenes, an oddity in itself. Detectives remained focused on preserving evidence, particularly from any surveillance cameras in the area. Their efforts paid off when they recovered footage from a house at the end of the alley where Monique's body had been found. The surveillance footage captured a U-Haul truck and a tan Buick driving north through the alley, leaving the area where Monique was found shortly after the gunshots were fired. The investigation took another turn when the detectives received a call from their lieutenant. A witness had reported seeing a U-Haul and a tan Buick at the earlier shooting at Wanda's home. The lieutenant asked, "Is your suspect vehicle an enormous storage vehicle?" When the detectives confirmed this, they knew they were onto something. The case continued to unfold when detectives discovered that Monique's black BMW was missing. With the vehicle's license plate in hand, they were soon notified by the Maple Grove Police Department that her car had been found at an empty house listed for sale, now a third crime scene. Detectives arrived at the Maple Grove house late that night. The contrast between the upscale neighborhood and the brutal crime they were investigating was striking to them. At the door, they discovered that the lockbox on the property was half empty, matching the partial lockbox found near Monique's body. Their search of the house uncovered chilling evidence of a struggle, including a pink acrylic fingernail lying on the floor, a detail that sent a shiver through even the most seasoned investigators. They canvassed the Maple Grove neighborhood for surveillance footage and struck gold with a camera directly across the street. What they found on the footage was as damning as it was disturbing. The video showed the U-Haul circling the street in broad daylight, its movements deliberate and unsettling. It made one pass, then came back around. A man exited the vehicle, walking confidently into the house, while the driver parked the U-Haul in the driveway. He too entered the home. Minutes later, the garage door opened. One of the men repositioned the U-Haul and went back inside. Then, both men emerged through the garage, one dragging Monique backward toward the vehicle. They loaded her into the back of the U-Haul before driving away. The footage revealed that the U-Haul had arrived at the house around 3 p.m. and left just 17 minutes later. By 5:40 p.m., almost 3 hours later, the shots at Wanda's home had been fired. The timeline painted a chilling picture, connecting the dots between the three crime scenes and tightening the noose around the suspects. What started as an investigation into a shooting had now become a multi-layered case of kidnapping, murder, and cold calculation. Detectives knew they were dealing with perpetrators who believed they could outsmart the system, but the evidence told a story they could not erase. 3 hours into the early morning of the new year, detectives faced a difficult task as they headed to the hospital to interview Momo. Fresh out of surgery and still groggy from pain medication, Momo was in serious condition. His first words upon waking were heartbreaking. "Where's Monique? I want to talk to her." The detectives knew they had to break the devastating news that the mother of his children was gone. When they told him, Momo broke down instantly, overcome with grief. The weight of the loss was almost unbearable, and the detectives gave him a moment to process before asking him to recount everything he could remember about the attack. Through tears, Momo began his story. "I remember giving Monique a kiss," he said, his voice breaking. "I told her, 'I'll see you later,' as she walked out the door." He never imagined that would be the last time he'd see her. The memory of that moment made him reflect on all the things they had taken for granted in life. He explained that later, he sat on the stairs, repeatedly calling Monique's phone. He estimated at least 90 times. "She said she'd be back by a certain time. When she says that, she's there," he said. But when 30 minutes passed, and then an hour, without a word from her, he knew something was wrong. He couldn't put his finger on it, but the unease in his gut was undeniable. "Then, the front door to the house opens," Momo continued. "Someone in all black, wearing a ski mask, came in, guns blazing." The words hung in the air as he recounted the moment. "I couldn't believe it. I got hit in the leg, the shoulder, and the back, just an inch from my heart. One shot hit me under my armpit, the same place I'd been holding my baby girl earlier when I put her to sleep." Momo's voice faltered as he described the horror. "My other baby girl was asleep on the couch, right where the shooter came in. They shot directly over her head to hit me. The sound woke her up instantly." The thought of his children being so close to the violence haunted him. Next thing I know, I'm lying in a pool of blood in the room upstairs. Detectives pressed for details, asking about the mask. Momo described it as a cotton ski mask, with only the eyes exposed, a single hole for their eyes. This detail solidified their growing theory. The entire attack had been orchestrated to target him. Nothing had been stolen. And the number of shots aimed directly at Momo, while sparing everyone else, made it clear that the intruders had come with one purpose, to kill him. When asked who might have wanted to harm him, Momo struggled to find an answer. "I don't know," he said, shaking his head. I don't know." The detectives pushed further, asking if he had any grudges or conflicts with anyone. After a moment, he mentioned one name, L.A. It wasn't much, but it was a start. The pieces of the puzzle were slowly coming together, and detectives now had a lead to follow. The motive behind the attack was beginning to reveal itself, but the scale and brutality of the crime still left them reeling. As the detectives pieced together the timeline of events, the horrifying reality of what had happened became clear. Just 1 hour after Momo was shot in the Humboldt Avenue home, Monique was transported to a dark alley near 13th Avenue and Russell Avenue North. There, in the desolate stillness, she was executed, shot 3 times in cold blood. Armed with this new information, detectives returned to the station to process what they had uncovered. The investigation was proving to be one of the most complex they'd encountered, with multiple crime scenes and a motive that seemed both convoluted and disturbingly petty. Though L.A. was a key figure in the narrative, detectives couldn't be sure of his involvement just yet. So their focus turned to finding the U-Haul seen at the 3 crime scenes. Using a license plate reader, detectives identified the U-Haul with Arizona plates and learned that it had already been returned. When they located the vehicle, the cargo door was open, airing out a strong odor of bleach and ammonia. Inside, detectives found damning evidence: 4 pink acrylic fingernails, identical to the one found at the Maple Grove house, and a Gorilla tape wrapper in the front passenger door. The tape matched the bindings used on Monique's hands, and the discovery cemented their confidence that this indeed was the homicide suspect's vehicle. The rental records led detectives to a couple who had rented the U-Haul. Brought in for questioning, the pair claimed they were drug users who had been approached by Cedric Berry, a known figure to law enforcement. According to them, Berry had promised payment in illicit substances if they rented the U-Haul for him. Cedric Berry's name sent up red flags. His stature fit the description of one of the men caught on surveillance footage at the Maple Grove house, making him a significant suspect. However, detectives were baffled by the fact that Berry didn't know Monique or Momo personally, raising questions about his involvement. The breakthrough came when forensic analysis revealed 6 of Cedric Berry's fingerprints on the adhesive side of the Gorilla tape used to bind Monique. This solidified his role in the crime, but detectives knew he wasn't acting alone. The footage from the Maple Grove house showed 2 men, and the second man's size ruled out L.A. as a possibility. The detectives now had a clearer picture of the events and 1 suspect in their crosshairs, but the search for the other accomplice was far from over. One of the detectives, familiar with the close connection between a man named Berry Davis and Cedric Berry, quickly recognized Berry Davis on the Maple Grove surveillance footage. The larger man with a distinct gait exiting the U-Haul and walking toward the house matched Berry Davis's description. Berry, Cedric's brother-in-law, was more than just a familial connection. He was Cedric's superior in the drug trade. While Cedric operated as a low-level dealer, Berry had established himself as a mid-level figure known for his influence and control. Initially, detectives speculated that the entire case could be tied to a drug deal gone wrong, based solely on their reputations. However, it was something deeper about their involvement that truly captured the detectives' attention. As detectives continued to piece together the tangled web of events, a clearer picture began to emerge. Cedric Berry and Berry Davis weren't just random perpetrators. They were low-level drug dealers working under a higher-level dealer known as Black Bag LA. As the investigation unfolded, detectives revealed that Black Bag LA was none other than Lyndon Wiggins, a prominent figure in the local drug trade with connections that reached far beyond the Minneapolis area. Given their connections and LA's reputation, the detectives couldn't help but wonder, was LA using these two dealers as foot soldiers to carry out his revenge? With each piece of evidence uncovered, the investigation shed more light on the dynamics between Monique, Momo, and the man Momo had identified as LA. Although LA was known as a highly successful distributor of illegal substances, that wasn't how Momo came to know him. The two had initially crossed paths as aspiring rappers under the same record label, Black Big. For a time, they shared a camaraderie, performing at the same clubs and traveling to places like California and Miami, often renting luxury cars and living the high life together. Monique also knew LA well. She and Momo had vacationed with him in Puerto Rico, gone clubbing, and spent time building what seemed to be a close friendship. But everything changed when Momo's music career took a pivotal turn. While they were living in California, Momo began working on a song called West Side, which caught the attention of established rapper Nipsey Hussle. LA, seeing an opportunity, offered to contribute a verse to the track. But Momo ultimately recorded the song with Nipsey Hussle instead. It was a decision that shifted the balance between the two men. Momo's star was rising, while LA's was fading, and the fallout from that moment sparked tension. The jealousy between them escalated as money and opportunities began flowing to Momo, leaving LA feeling sidelined. Despite their differences, every time the two met, they would part with a handshake and words of affirmation like, "Man, I love you." Momo never believed LA wanted him dead, but he recognized him as someone who harbored unresolved resentment. As the investigation deepened, detectives gained access to files from a federal investigation into LA's drug operation that had already been underway before Monique's murder. Among the recovered evidence were text messages that provided a shocking glimpse into a simmering feud between LA and Momo, one that began as a contract dispute, but quickly escalated into something far more sinister. The texts painted a picture of jealousy, wounded pride, and suspicion that Momo had betrayed him. By April 2019, Momo and LA were no longer speaking. Then came the turning point. Momo and some associates were taken into custody on firearm charges, only to be released shortly afterward. Around the same time, a large marijuana grow operation tied to LA was raided by law enforcement. LA began to suspect that Momo had snitched to the authorities in exchange for his release. Though detectives had no evidence to support this theory, it was clear that LA believed it, and that belief fueled his resentment. The final blow to their relationship may have come in December 2019, just weeks before the murder, when Momo posted the December 16th video on social media, flaunting large amounts of cash in a flashy display that likely poured salt into LA's wounds. Momo explained to detectives that while LA didn't know where he lived, he was aware of his relationship with Monique. This knowledge led LA to devise a plan to use her as a means to get to him. Phone records revealed that LA began searching for Momo's Facebook profile on December 26th, shortly after the video was posted, and again on December 29th. 2 days later, Monique was dead. Detectives couldn't ignore the timing. It was too deliberate to be coincidental. Detectives now believed that Cedric Berry and Berry Davis were hired by LA to carry out his revenge. However, there was one glaring problem. There was no physical evidence linking LA directly to Monique's murder. Proving his involvement would be an uphill battle. For now, detectives focused on building their case against Cedric Berry and Berry Davis. Cedric Berry was the first to be taken into custody. On January 2, 2020, after detectives searched the U-Haul truck, law enforcement tracked him to the DoubleTree Hotel. When detectives attempted to question him, Barry refused to cooperate, stating, "I'm not just going to sit here and confess." Fortunately, his vehicle provided the evidence they needed. A search warrant revealed critical items: black tape, identical to the gorilla tape used to bind Monique's wrists, a ski mask with a single hole for the eyes matching Momo's description of the shooter, and two-way radios. Each piece of evidence strengthened the case against him. In a stunning twist, Thomas Barry, a well-known community activist and the brother of Cedric Barry, came out publicly, condemning the senseless killing of Monique, only to find out just hours after his heartfelt statement that the Minneapolis Police Department had arrested his own brother for the crime.
You know, every time one of these shootings happen, what I see constantly is that these are black men who are doing this. And I'm here to say that these are not black men who are doing this, these are black males. It's the difference between a male and a man. Men don't kill women and men don't kill children. And men are not in their community killing members of the community.
The revelation stunned the community, given Thomas's reputation for advocating against violence and promoting unity. Despite the personal devastation of discovering his brother's involvement, Thomas stood by his earlier comments, reaffirming his condemnation of the act and emphasizing that justice must prevail, regardless of familial ties. Shortly after, detectives also received a tip that Cedric Barry and Barry Davis were known to frequent a clothing store near a Walmart in Brooklyn Center. Investigating further, a detective visited the Walmart, where an employee provided a critical lead, a receipt for items purchased on December 31st, the day of the murder. The receipt listed two-way radios, bleach, and ammonia. When the employee offered to pull surveillance footage, the detective's suspicions were confirmed. The footage showed Barry Davis making the purchases. Barry Davis, however, was more elusive. He managed to evade authorities for months after being indicted on February 20, 2020. It wasn't until May 1, 2020, that Davis was finally captured. With both men in custody, detectives had the evidence and the suspects they needed to move forward with murder charges. The evidence against Cedric Barry and Barry Davis painted a damning picture. They were linked by surveillance footage, fingerprints, and items tying them to the crime scenes. The detectives believed these two men acted as hired hands for LA, the mastermind behind the plan. While the physical evidence to directly implicate LA remained elusive, the circumstantial evidence and timeline of events pointed squarely to his involvement. The case had come full circle, but the fight for justice was far from over. The road ahead would involve untangling the complex motives behind Monique's murder and ensuring that all responsible parties were held accountable. As the detectives dove deeper into the suspects' phone records, they uncovered a significant breakthrough that tied everything together. They found that their phones had pinged at each of the crime scenes, creating a breadcrumb trail of their movements throughout the night. But even more chilling was what they found in Monique's call log leading up to the house showing on December 29, 2019. A voicemail left on Monique's phone caught their attention.
"Hi, Monique. My name is Lisa Pawlowski. I'm interested in the property Niagara Lane North in Maple Grove, Minnesota. Just give me a call. This is a property that I'm really interested in, and I'm hoping that after the walkthrough that it is one that I decide to go with."
Detectives found it odd that the caller had reached out directly to Monique's personal cell phone, a rare occurrence in the real estate industry. Monique, ever the professional, initially scheduled the Maple Grove house showing for December 29th at 11 a.m. But when Monique arrived at the property for the showing, the caller and her supposed husband didn't show up. Instead, Monique received a call from the same woman who asked an unusual question. "My husband and I have a bet. Can you tell us if the stove is gas or electric?" Monique answered the question and waited, but no one ever arrived. Detectives now believed this call was a setup, with the kidnappers mapping out their plan to ensure Monique would be alone at the house. The voicemail's tone struck the detectives as eerie. How could such a sweet voice be connected to such a heinous crime? They played the message repeatedly, trying to identify who the caller might be. Then Officer Jesse happened to walk by. With his extensive knowledge of Momo and Lyndon Wiggins, the detectives asked for his input. To their surprise, Officer Jesse immediately recognized the voice. It belonged to Elsa Segura, a 29-year-old former Hennepin County probation officer with a known romantic connection to Lyndon L.A. Wiggins. Officer Jesse had listened to countless jail calls where L.A. spoke with Elsa, and he was certain it was her voice on the voicemail. Detectives learned that Elsa had been terminated from her position after lying to her supervisors about her relationship with L.A., especially following a police raid on her home. Lisa Pawlowski was just an alias Elsa had created to lure Monique into the deadly trap. For detectives, this revelation was the moment when all the pieces fell into place. The voicemail became the definitive link between L.A. and the killers, solidifying the theory that he had orchestrated Monique's murder. Elsa's involvement tied L.A. directly to the crime. Armed with this critical information, detectives immediately sought out Elsa Segura. When they brought her to the station, they were nervous about whether she would admit her involvement. They played her the voicemail, and Elsa sat calmly as it played. When asked if she was familiar with the call, Elsa responded, "Okay, I mean I made a phone call, but I didn't know what was going to be the outcome of that phone call." She then asked for an attorney, clearly attempting to minimize her role in the crime. A forensic search of Elsa's phone, however, told a different story. Her internet search history painted a picture of mounting anxiety on the night of the murder. She had searched for topics like confession times, immunity in the law, and even incinerator. They found long conversations between Elsa and L.A. that further highlighted her role in the crime and his influence over her actions. When detectives finally sat down with L.A., his arrogance became apparent. Confident in his ability to outtalk anyone, he denied all involvement, laughing off the detective's assertions. He claimed there was no rift between him and Momo over money or accusations of snitching. When confronted about Elsa's role, he dismissed the idea that he had put her up to setting Monique up. However, the detectives had uncovered more breadcrumbs from phone analysis. While the killers had discarded Monique's phone to cover their tracks, they kept their own phones, unknowingly leaving a trail of evidence. This included visits to a store where they purchased a burner phone, the one that was used to coordinate the abduction. Despite LA's denials, the evidence told a different story. The calls, the burner phone, and Elsa's direct involvement all pointed to LA as the mastermind behind the plot. The detectives now had a clearer picture. Monique wasn't the intended target. Momo was. But in orchestrating this twisted plan, L.A. had destroyed the lives of Monique, her family, and ultimately, those he manipulated to carry out his revenge. Following the interview, detectives arrested 36-year-old Lyndon L.A. Wiggins, bringing all four key suspects in Monique Bao's murder into custody. Prosecutors filed identical charges against Wiggins, Cedric Berry, Barry Davis, and Elsa Segura, holding them equally accountable for their roles in the horrific crime. Each was indicted on charges of kidnapping and murdering Monique, as well as the attempted murder of John Mitchell Momo. The coordinated effort by law enforcement and prosecutors ensured that all those responsible for the brutal events of December 31st, 2019 would face justice. But there was one more. Although the investigation had successfully led to the arrests of the four primary suspects, L.A., Cedric Berry, Barry Davis, and Elsa Segura, there was one more individual who would face accountability. Detectives identified the driver of the tan Buick as Shantae Davis, the wife of Barry Davis and sister of Cedric and Thomas Berry, the activist. Shantae's involvement in the crime extended beyond driving the vehicle. She also drove her husband to pick up the U-Haul used in the abduction and provided logistical support to her husband and brother. Additionally, surveillance footage showed her purchasing a cell phone that was later used in the crime. For her role in the conspiracy, Shante Davis was charged and convicted of aiding and abetting the kidnapping and murder of Monique Bau. While her actions were not as direct as those of the killers, they were instrumental in facilitating the horrific events. As trials for the key players drew to a close, Monique's loved ones spoke about the profound impact her loss had on their lives. Among them was her mother, Wanda, whose grief was as raw as it had been on the night she learned of her daughter's death.
Wanda Williams Bau, W-A-N-D-A. Do I have to spell it? Yeah.
We remember you from trial.
On December 30th, 2019, I said goodnight and I love you to my daughter, Monique Bau, for the last time. This would also be the last time her babies would sleep next to their mother. I still say goodnight to her. And I tell her I love her. It's just to her picture. And both of her girls, they say goodnight to her too. And they kiss and hug her picture. And they sleep with her picture of their mommy under their pillow. And they both had to get each of their own because they would tussle over it. So the director of the school was kind enough to make them each their own. Monique loved being a mother. I tell her girls that often, just how much she loved being their mommy. They have to take my word for it because she's not here to tell them herself. And I know she would tell them every single day. I know she would. Legends, Monique. Monique's oldest daughter, Legend. She likes to pray, pretend. And we had a wand, Princess Wand. And she turned me into a frog and I had to act like a frog. And then she turned me into her mommy. And she said, I said, I'm sorry, Legend, I can't be your mommy. And she says, Gammy, do it. Just do it. And then I put on my best Monique impression, and I act like her mommy. I said what Monique, I thought Monique would say, and I picked her up, and she whispered and hugged me so tight and said, please don't leave me again. She didn't want to leave you. She did. She should be here. Monique was stolen from us and murdered just 22 days after Legacy turned one. We just celebrated her first birthday. My God! My God! Legacy won't have any memory of her beautiful mother. And the three short years that Legend have had of her doesn't go without notice that they were very short. Because Legend said to me one day, I didn't have a lot of time with her. And she's right. We all didn't have a lot of time with her, but they had the least. A mother is so important, and everyone that has a mother understands how important a mother is, and they don't get to experience that, and they had one of the best. She made me want to be a better mother, and I get the chance to do that with her children, but she should be here, and I can never replace Monique. Joan can never replace Monique, the other grandmother. We have a lot of hard questions to answer, and Legend is already asking them. I was reading the girls their bedtime prayers book, and there was a verse, Jeremiah 15:20, that reads, I will rescue you and save you, says the Lord. And Legend says to me, how is God gonna save us if he didn't save my mommy? That's a question a child should never have to ask. And it's not a question that I should have to answer. Monique didn't have to die. She didn't have to die. It could have let her go at some point. Those defendants could have let her go at some point. You got her key. You had access to where you are, to where Momo was. Not that I wanted him to die. I'm not saying that, but none of this should have happened. But Monique did not have to die. I didn't have to throw her out like she was garbage either. My baby was so precious to me. To all of us, she was so valuable. How dare they? Monique had her whole life ahead of her. She was doing very well in her career as a real estate agent for Chris Lindoff. She loved creating searches for her clients, and she was excited when she found the perfect home. She was an amazing friend to many. There's a lot of them here today. She is loved and missed by many. Most of all, Monique loved her two girls. She said she was going to be a soccer mom, and she was on her way to do that. That was taken from her. I'm having an extremely difficult time trying to process what happened to my daughter. These defendants treated my daughter as if they were, as if she were less than human. My daughter came face to face with pure evil that New Year's Eve. She had to literally fight for her life. And I believe wholeheartedly that Monique died protecting her babies. She knew her babies were home and was not going to give up without a fight. My daughter didn't have a stand a chance with these two soulless defendants. But they are not men. Every time I see a U-Haul, which is quite often, I can't help but visualizing Monique in the back, being tortured. And I can only imagine what was being said to her, or how many times she was being called out of her name, or how many times she begged for her life. Only these two defendants, Monique and God, truly know what happened. And that U-Haul. And they made sure my daughter did not live to tell about it. What I do know is that my daughter died not knowing if her babies were okay. I know she was terrified from the beginning to the end. I know she did all that she possibly could not to be taken. Because of the brutal attack and murder of my beautiful Monique. We have to rely on memories and pictures. When they killed my daughter, they made sure that there would be no more memories made. They decided that Monique would have celebrated her last parties, the birthday parties for her girls. She had her last Thanksgiving, her last Christmas. her girls will grow up without her and be motherless. When the defendants ambushed and overpowered Monique, they used her power to take her life. And I'm asking you, Your Honor, to please use your power to make sure they spend the rest of their miserable, insignificant lives in prison. Thank you. Thank you.
When the trials concluded, the key players were convicted of her kidnapping, torture, and murder, a crime that shocked the Minneapolis community with its sheer viciousness. Evidence revealed that Monique had been held captive for about 3 hours as the defendants tried to force her to reveal the whereabouts of her boyfriend, Momo, following his falling out with L.A. During her captivity, Monique endured horrific abuse. She suffered scratches, bruises, a chipped tooth, and the ripping off of some of her acrylic nails. Ultimately, she was shot in the face, heart, and spine before being left in a North Minneapolis alley. For their roles in her kidnapping and murder, each of the four defendants was sentenced to life without parole. Prosecutors identified Cedric Berry as the likely shooter, who later used Monique's key to enter Wanda's home, where he shot Momo multiple times in front of their young daughters. During Cedric Berry and Berry Davis's trial, Momo testified about his fallout with L.A., who had accused him of stealing music after he left the label in 2019. Fearing retaliation from L.A., Momo took significant steps to protect himself and his family. Momo, Monique, and their two daughters had already relocated from their Coon Rapids home in an effort to evade any potential threats. He kept their new address a closely guarded secret, ensuring that L.A. could not easily find them. Despite these precautions, the danger remained as L.A.'s suspicions and jealousy continued to escalate. On January 17, 2023, Judge Peter Cahill sentenced Shante Davis, the driver of the Buick, to 90 days for aiding and abetting the crimes in the Hennepin County Jail, with credit for 10 days already served. After 30 days, she became eligible for electronic home monitoring. Additionally, her 18-month prison sentence was stayed, contingent on 2 years of probation. Shante was also ordered to pay fines exceeding $570 and to adhere to strict probation conditions, including no contact with Monique Bao's family. While her sentence was far less severe than those of the primary perpetrators, her actions, such as driving Berry Davis to retrieve the U-Haul, played a role in facilitating the tragic events, leaving Monique's family deeply impacted. Unfortunately, not long after the court procedures ended, and the family began to feel some relief, knowing that all those involved would spend the rest of their lives in prison, the pursuit of justice for Monique faced unexpected setbacks. Despite being initially convicted and sentenced to life in 2021, Elsa Segura's conviction was overturned by the Minnesota Supreme Court in January 2024, citing faulty jury instructions. This stunning reversal allowed Segura to plead guilty to kidnapping later that year, resulting in a drastically reduced 20-year prison sentence. The case of Lyndon L.A. Wiggins took a similarly startling turn. His conviction was overturned in March 2024 on the same legal grounds, leaving him to await retrial. However, as a saving grace, Wiggins will still face the most serious charges against him in the new trial, first-degree murder, ensuring that the opportunity for justice remains. For Monique's family, these developments were a painful reminder of the complexities and fragility of the justice system. What seemed like a closed chapter has been reopened, prolonging their anguish, but leaving hope that full accountability may still be achieved. What do you think about this case? Monique Bao's story is a devastating reminder of how senseless violence can destroy lives. She wasn't involved in the feud that cost her life. Her only crime was being someone's girlfriend. Monique was a dedicated mother, a successful real estate professional, and a beloved member of her family and community. Yet, her life was stolen in a vicious act of premeditated revenge, leaving her family shattered and her daughters motherless. That night, Monique never made it to her cousin's New Year's Eve dinner, a celebration she had been eagerly planning. But her killers heartlessly continued with their own plans, walking into an Applebee's with friends just moments after killing her, dining and socializing as though their heinous act was inconsequential. What do you think drives people to commit such horrifying acts, then casually return to normal life as if nothing happened? Is it a complete lack of empathy or something even darker? What responsibility do you think should fall on individuals like Elsa Segura, who knowingly participated in setting up Monique? Her sentence was reduced from life without parole to 20 years after her conviction was overturned. That means she could be eligible for release in just under 10 more years. Do you think that's justice? Should those who enable such violence face the same level of punishment as those who directly commit it? Let's continue the conversation down in the comments section below. As always, I'll meet you there. In these stories, there are no perfect victims, just imperfect individuals navigating different roles in life. Monique was more than Momo's girlfriend. She was a loving daughter, niece, cousin, mother, and friend to many who now mourn her loss. She will forever remain in the hearts of those who cherished and loved her, not because she was perfect, but because she was perfectly wonderful in their eyes. This is why I extend my gratitude to the victims for being beacons of love and light, despite any flaws that may emerge from their stories. So, thank you, Monique, for being an example of love and light. May you rest in eternal peace. That wraps up this episode of Sleuthy Stories. Thanks for joining me as we uncover the twists and turns of real-life cases. If you enjoyed the show, don't forget to follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you have a moment, please leave a rating. It really helps more true crime fans find us. Want to see the visuals that go with today's case? You can find the full video version on my YouTube channel, Sleuthy Lucy. Check the link in the description. I'll be back soon with another case. But until then, keep your wits sharp and your curiosity sharper.